Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and today we are interviewing another member of the System 2011 faculty, the last big system that we'll be doing ever, April 15th through 17th in New York City. And today we've got a very special guest. A couple of days ago, we had a chance to interview one of our guests, longtime friends and colleagues, Brian Kurtz. And that gave Brian and I an opportunity to brag about Michael Fishman, our guest today, because Michael won't do it. He's very modest, but we're going to try to pull some gems from him and let you know what he brings to the party, which is significant. And let me just give you one thumbnail story about Michael so you get a sense of where he comes from and what he's accomplished and what he continues to do. A few years ago, Gary Bensavenga, who is universally acknowledged as the most effective and successful direct mail copywriter of his generation, even big gun copywriters just acknowledge it. They don't even get into a debate about it. They knew Gary was number one. Put on his one and only seminar in his 40-plus year career, and it was a three-day thing, and Gary was the only presenter. However, he felt the need to make one exception to that rule. He felt that he needed to have Michael Fishman give a talk. And the reason for that is very interesting. Well, Gary's most successful letter was a letter written for Rodale. And many of you probably know Rodale as a company that specializes in health and fitness books. They're one of the great, ultimate, amazing direct marketing success stories of all time. It started out as a very modest organic gardening publication, and one thing led to another, and is one of the biggest privately owned publishing companies in the world, all direct marketing driven. So that's Rodale, and that was one of Gary's clients, and Gary's most successful letter was so effective and converted so well that it was physically mailed, not email, physical mail, 100 million times, and that is a lot of mail, and you don't mail like that unless the cash register is ringing. And in Gary's case, he had a very unique relationship with his clients. He only had a few big top gun mailers that did huge volume, like Rodale, and Gary got paid a commission of a nickel every time the letter got mailed. So when this letter went out 100 million times, if you do the math, that works out to $5 million paid to Gary Bensavenga for writing a single sales letter. Not bad. But there's always two halves to every great direct mail or any kind of direct marketing success story. There's the copy, the advertisement that actually makes the thing work. And then there is the list that you mail to. And one of the big challenges in direct mail, and then you can extrapolate this to any medium, whether it's internet or TV or radio ads or newspaper ads, anything that works. Once you find something that works, your next big challenge is to find all the possible places that you can run the ad profitably. And that is a really important skill, requires a lot of market knowledge and a lot of insight. So the person who figured out all the 100 million different, was it literally 100 million different places to mail, but figured out all the many different places to mail this winning letter so that it ended up in 100 million different mailboxes was none other than our guest today, Michael Fishman. And Michael started out in the business as a list broker back in the early 80s. And a list broker is a person. Well, maybe we'll ask Michael to explain what a list broker is, and then we're going to talk about the evolution of his career, because being a list broker was only the beginning. It happens to be a great foundation for mastering and getting really expert at direct marketing. But it is where he started, and it might be interesting for people to know what a direct mail broker is and does, and what the important things that a broker brings to the mix. And we're also going to talk about the evolution of Michael's career and how he's expanded to all media, especially the internet, and what he brings to that party too. So welcome, Michael Fishman.
Hey, Ken. Good morning, and thanks for having me. Just want to apologize for my voice, just because it's I just got back from a trip, and I know it sounds a little off, but I feel fine, and I'm excited to talk to you. I thought I'd put my modesty aside and start the call by telling you the 20 most awesome things about me.
Great. Hey, this is a breakthrough.
I got to
tell you, it's like pulling teeth to get Michael to brag on himself. It's amazing.
Yeah,
let me know. What are these things?
I'm just joking. You're going to have to
put that in. Oh, no. Oh, God. Well, we'll keep working on you.
Okay.
So, List Broker. Now, again, you know, a lot of our listeners are of course, internet marketers. But as I always say, and I think it's proven over and over again, that the insight and savvy and cunning, even, that people from the direct mail world bring to internet marketing is just awesome. I mean, it's such a discipline when every mail that you send costs real money. Some of the sharpest people around are people that worked and succeeded and thrived in the direct mail environment.
Right.
So you started out as a list broker. So what does a list broker do?
Well, a list broker is someone that supports clients who do direct mail by understanding their offer and understanding their product and all the different aspects of their product and their marketing offer, and then identifying the list that through a number of means and a number of sort of ways of evaluating lists, identifying the lists that are best suited to which to circulate the mail piece for the offer, you know. I mean, we look. Someone who really looks at it very deeply at multiple levels will look not only at what is the product, what does it cost, what are these people interested in, but also some other things like whether those people are, you know, whether people that buy this product would typically be men or women, what age would they be, would they have brand sensitivity. You know, what would their sensibilities be like? What would, you know, what are their socioeconomic level? And maybe not most important, but very importantly, what their transaction behavior is like. You know, do we know from their past, do we know from the past transaction based on the list they're found on, would they be willing to pay cash with order, you know, for a product, as opposed to what a lot of publishers do is enable people to say, bill me later. So are they a bill me type customer? Or are they a cash customer? Are they, you know, very promotionally oriented? Do they respond to sweepstakes and huge promises? Or are they more serious and, you know, focused on editorial and content and really just the heart of the matter? So we look at lots of things that, you know, many things that are obvious and quite a few that are not so obvious, which is really more the stuff that's under the surface and in many respects is what's most powerful about driving transactions is the stuff that's not quite so obvious.
So in direct mail, in contrast with the way most people do internet marketing, most people who do internet marketing are driving leads sort of, I guess, cold, for lack of a better word. They're buying AdWords. They're doing SEO. They're buying banners. And they don't really necessarily know the buying behavior of the people they're showing their ads to. They, you know, for instance, if it's a sports-related offer and they're running it on a sports-related site, they know, hey, you know, we're sort of in the ballpark. But they don't generally have that kind of detailed intelligence about the buying behavior of who people are marketing to. And I think this illustrates something really, really, really important about not only direct marketing, but internet marketing, and really all marketing, is whenever we can, we're always looking for people that have already bought in the arena that we are selling. And this is, I think this is what makes direct marketing, this is an aspect of direct marketing that's little utilized in internet marketing so far. That hopefully that's going to change, but you're going to be an influencer in making that change. But that's sort of one of the basis of all direct marketing is, hey, let's not try to sell to the world. Let's try to sell to the people who've already exhibited a tendency by action to buy this kind of thing.
Yeah, and you know, in some quarters, direct mail might be looked at as the old world, even though direct mail remains a very robust channel today, and lots of people who begin their business on the web come to me or look out, you know, look around and say, well, gee, I'm not just a web business, I'm in the health business, or I'm in the golf business, or I'm, you know, my passion is my product, not as much as I love the channel of the web. You know, where else should I be marketing? And so many people at this point that have started businesses on the web look at direct mail as another potential channel so that they're not leaving business on the table, or more rigorously said, so that they have the opportunity to add value to the lives of more people with their products and services. And the thing about direct mail that's really cool is just the exquisite level of targeting that's available, which, you know, I think is just so exciting. And that's, you know, it's not like an old school sort of old world thing to say. I mean, targeting is just amazing when you can look at people's prior, as you said, prior transactions, and not only know that they bought, but know the month in which they bought. If there was a variable, you know, cost to the sale, like in a catalog, you could specify how much was purchased in their lifetime with that marketer was. You know, if we say we want someone who has spent over $100, would that be on their very last purchase or the cumulative lifetime of their purchases with that marketer? Would it be their first time buying with that company, or are they a multi-buyer, meaning have they returned multiple times? Did they use a credit card or not? You know, what state or city they live in? Just some really, really fascinating things, and all these things actually drive very specifically different behaviors. I mean, when we look at a large magazine list or a catalog list, the brand new people are in a much are more in a buying mode. They're more in an exploratory mode to buy other goods and services around that same subject. I mean, if somebody has subscribed to a health magazine just in the last month, they have not yet really forged their loyalty with that publication, and they're very open to other sources of comparable information. If they've subscribed to that health magazine 5 years ago and have renewed every year, there's obviously a loyalty there because their needs in some way are being met. So they're less likely to jump to another source of comparable information. So a list in the direct mail world, because of the wonderful targeting opportunity, it's not just a group of a million people. I mean, the people who subscribed just in the last year and have not yet renewed, and those who have renewed, are totally different animals. And we you know, we keep them apart and we mail them and track them separately, just because their behavior is so, so different.
And these are all things that a list broker knows. So if somebody comes to you and says, "Well, I have, you know, such and such to sell," you're able to, you know, it's not just a matter of opening a catalog and saying, oh, we can mail these people, we can mail those people. It's knowing all kinds of specific parameters that make the probability, that raise the probability of success for any given mailing a lot higher.
Right.
There's two things I'd like to talk about. One I didn't prepare you for, so but I bet you'll be able to answer. And then the other is how people that are currently marketing on the internet and generating customer lists can use their own lists internally better, which is probably the safest, quickest way to get involved in direct mail. In other words, you already generated a so-called house list. Why not look at that list and figure out how to use it? But let's talk about the way you rolled out the famous Gary Bensavenga letter. Because again, the challenge, and this is something that anybody that's experienced will appreciate. You know, when you're starting out, you're trying to find a letter that's going to work, and then when you find one, that's great. And then as soon as you find something that works, you realize, wow, where else could I plug this in? And when you see people that have made, you know, fortunes in direct marketing, it's not just the letter. You know, there's this myth that, hey, you're just one sales letter away from a fortune. And that's partially true, but you also need a network of places to plug that letter in to harvest that fortune. So what can you talk a little bit about the things that you did to help find so many different outlets for that that amazing Rodale letter that Gary Bensavenger wrote?
Sure, sure. Well, this was for a book called New Choices in Natural Healing, which was not a continuity or a membership. It was what we call a one-shot book, for $28 or $30 plus shipping and handling, no further obligation to buy anything, although, of course, those buyers go into the database and do go and buy other things in the future. Before we even look at the list segmentation and the marketing, there's another really important lesson, because this is one of the greatest case histories in all of direct marketing, not just publishing and not just health publishing. This book had great research around it, great research on what the best title would be, on what the best content would be. So it really had great organic roots from a customer survey perspective. It was really developed and validated by good customer research. And yet, when it launched, the first two pieces of copy, which mailed head-to-head in the very first test and were written by two of the best writers in the world, both failed miserably. And so, you know, there's really a lesson here, for any channel of business, any, you know, internet, TV, what have you, your first result is not always the best result you can produce. And in this case, as I said, there was good research behind the book and many champions in the company supporting it, not just because they were emotionally attached to it, but because there was good hard data that the book should succeed. And that was when Gary was brought in after the first two creative efforts failed. and he went out without any test against any other writer. They just thought, well, if Gary can't make this work, then, you know, we'll set it aside. And so Gary wrote what's called a bookalog, which is a sort of a hybrid word joining the words book and catalog. And it looks, you know, sort of like what TV Guide used to look like, or Soap Opera Digest, or those sort of digest size magazines that you see at the checkout counter at supermarkets, even still today. And the bookalog was the promotion format, and it was maybe 60-some-odd pages, which is a lot of writing, although worth $5 million in remuneration, I would say.
I actually have a copy of it. Yeah, it's it might have been as many as 64 pages, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
And I have to tell you, I was really surprised. Gary sent a copy to me, and I was really surprised when I got it, because initially it wasn't obvious that it was a sales letter.
Well, right, exactly. And I think even today when we talk about marketing on the web, the first thing that you do one of the first things that you do, I think, if you're good, is to create a sense of reciprocity with your prospect by showing, A, that you care, and B, that you're willing to provide lots of information and value before there's any transaction. And that certainly was the case with the bookalog, because it wasn't 64 pages of please buy this book. It was a lot of content. There actually was a table of contents, and there were different health topics in there and really some good information, so that if someone read that but didn't buy the book, they could feel good about their experience and that they actually learned something they could use. So in the list test, you know, even the biggest companies, you know, I always counsel, no matter how much money they had, to always spend the least to learn the most. And so, you know, we would test maybe, you know, 8 or 10 lists at the minimum quantity, and select lists, each of which was representative of a particular category of list or a particular sort of variable test that we wanted to do, like men against women or some other kind of, you know, maybe age, so that we could learn some things that were not about a list but about our marketplace. And when we, you know, so we set up maybe a some obvious things like a vitamin buyer list and a health magazine list and a health book buyer list like the ones that Boardroom had, which are so productive even to this day, and even some catalog lists and some donor lists, the kinds of things that were far from obvious, but which we know from experience, because those people are transaction-oriented, they're the right age, they're the right socioeconomic, they're the right sensibility. When you have a strong promotion, because health is such a universal subject, as is money, health and money, the two big things that people sometimes think are niches that are totally not niches, because everybody has to deal with health and money. health offers can mail to a wide array of lists beyond the health category if the product and creative are strong enough. So in this case, the 8 or 10 lists that we tested all worked extremely well, which even for winning books, you don't necessarily hit every ball out of the park in your initial test. But in this case, even the one or two lists that we put in there that would typically would sort of be resistant, you know, sort of your stubborn performers, they just popped. And so it was just like almost like a market signal in, you know, in stocks, like when, you know, people that read the market look at a whole series of indicators and say, okay, it's undeniable, this is what's happening here. So I read the results, and, you know, my guidance immediately was, we have to just roll this thing out as big and bad as we possibly can, because this is a very, very unusual set of results from this market test. I mean, really unprecedented. I mean, and at that time, you know, Rodale, with my guidance, you know, in terms of list segmentation and list identification, had done already dozens of books. So they had the entire legacy of, like, their prior 8 or 10 years building that book business of other results that they could actually look at to bring some relevance and some perspective to this campaign. So that's how it started.
Great. Wow. So is this the combination of having a topic of very broad appeal, knowing the demographic, you know, the age group and the economic background, and then the other important thing, and that I want to really make sure everybody grasps, these were lists of people who were known doers. Either they were buying via direct marketing, or they were donating via direct marketing, and that makes all the difference in the world. And because when we're selling either via direct mail or whatever it is, infomercials or the internet, we're really only hitting the segment of the marketplace that buys from these vehicles. So we're never likely to reach the entire marketplace. We're very happy if we can reach that universe of people that just is in the habit of seeing stuff they like via the internet or via mail, or whatever, and buying it.
Right. If we have, in the example I gave before about the renewals versus the first year subscribers of a magazine, if the magazine is 2 million subscribers, and I don't do the segmentation to figure out what part of those 2 million can work for me, I mean, if I assume all 2 million can work for me, and I test a piece of the 2 million and fail, I'm done, and I have no access to those 2 million names because I haven't done the work to figure out what segment is productive for me. If I take the first-year subscribers and mail them against the renewals or test them against the renewals, and one succeeds and one fails, let's assume it's a 50-50 split, I've now saved 1 million names of marketing circulation because I determined which piece of the 2 million could work for me. So it's, you know, and this happens on, you know, any list of, you know, good size, you know, maybe 200,000 or higher. This is the kind of slicing and dicing that we do to make sure that we're, you know, giving it a fair shake, not trying to access the entire thing when there's lots of subsets inside it that are going to work in very, very different ways from each other.
Well, it's probably a general principle here that everybody can at least test, and I would even go so far as to say should test, which is a principle you alluded to earlier, which is new subscribers and new buyers tend to behave differently than long-time subscribers or long-time
right.
buyers. The long-time people are loyal and they're great, but it's the new people who tend to be, put it simply, looser with their checkbook. They're more enthusiastic. The fields may be new to them. And everybody probably has this experience in their life. If you think back, when you're shopping for a new car, suddenly you become car crazy. And you're reading this and you're reading that. When you start a new hobby, you start buying all these magazines and all these books and going to all these shops and maybe trade shows, probably at a higher level than somebody that's been in the field for years. So I'm going to ask you for your advice on this. That would lead me to believe that one thing that internet marketers could do right now today is be a lot more conscious and aware of their new buyers and develop programs to make as many offers and as many interesting possibilities available to their new customers as they can think of. Because
right.
that's likely to have the best yield.
Yeah. Well, it's tempting to left click on send because putting aside the cost of it costs a little more depending on your who's deploying your emails for you to send 1 million versus 1,000. But for many people, given the size of their list, it's the same to send everybody at one time versus just a subset. So the cost doesn't change, like you alluded to postage before. But, in terms of caring about your list and really, honoring people's time and attention and their patronage of your business, I do think there's value in understanding who's who and doing some testing to determine who can be left out of certain campaigns or, what part of your list really is the right part to sell a new product that you've developed in a specific, maybe a niche or a subcategory of what your overall business has been so far. It's seductive to mail to everybody when, if you were in the world of postage, as Ken's, if you've been pointing out, Ken, it would be prohibitive. So if we held ourselves to somewhat of a standard in terms of, moving into the database world. Look, here's the thing. Lots of people that began their businesses offline who have that segmentation in their offline database, then, later on what they did was try to figure out what the email addresses are for all these offline customers. When you do the reverse, when you start with an email database, and if you're shipping hard product, you know people's postal address, or if you're providing digital product or teleclasses or things like that, you may need to find a means to get their physical address. But once you start dealing with customers at their physical address via postage or via shipping product, you will need to know who's who and function in a database environment, which is a fancy term which simply means to know what people have done and some of the, when they did it, what they spent, and some of the basic characteristics of their transaction so that you can set up little subsets of your larger list to be as effective as you can, not just for the financial ramifications and the cost of marketing, but to be responsible and to really honor your people, give them the best possible experience to, keep open rates high, click-through rates high, and to be as relevant as you possibly can.
And this is a sort of a natural discipline that develops in direct mail just because of the cost. If you sell size 11 shoes, let's say, you now have a special size 12 shoe, you're not going to mail your size 12 shoe offer to the people that we're size 11. It wouldn't be effective, but it would also be somewhat disrespectful, let's say, to the people that are wearing size 11. What do they want to get an offer for something that's clearly not in their range of buying behaviors? And so it's a matter of not getting better, like you said, getting better open rates, getting better read rates, getting better response rates, and maintaining the relationship. And this is something I always say is, just because you have 100,000 people or a million people on an email list doesn't mean you really have that many people on your list. That,
yeah,
a whole bunch of them mentally opted out a long time ago, just haven't gone to the extra step of unsubscribing.
And I think, Ken, that there's just an ongoing buzz that does not go away about the impact of social media. But I think, to the extent that companies, more and more companies with every passing day, are using the social platforms to interact with their customers around customer service, answering questions, these kinds of things, led by companies like Zappos, or JetBlue, companies like this, the prominence of companies dealing quickly with customers and showing that type of caring relationship for literally on a one-on-one basis is raising the expectations of customers for the overall functionality of these businesses, and that these businesses will know not to promote me for something that I already bought. I mean, the wrong size shoe is one thing, but to ask me to buy something that I've already bought from you is that really can be perceived as like a disrespect, or, a lack of appreciation for something that I did. Even if I was pleased with it, I'm now concerned that you don't recognize me as your customer because I thought we had this relationship. So, I think there's a lot of forces at work and at play that are all pointing toward the same thing, which is that, businesses are comprised of people. Even faceless brands like Nike, Coca-Cola, Starbucks, etc., are showing their face more and more, or at least employees inside those organizations are bringing a human side to what previously were just these big iconic behemoth-type brands. I think that shows up in how you manage the asset called your list, and what people... how people expect to be treated.
And you point out with the Zappos and companies like that, even Amazon, which makes it so easy and pleasant to do returns, all the companies that are going that way, they are really they're raising the bar for what online customers expect. Maybe years ago, it was a Wild West scenario, and you were getting sort of the early adopters, and they were a little bit more robust in what they were willing to put up with because of the novelty of it all. But now this is, obviously online marketing, online sales has become, absolutely mainstream. And the mainstream standards are the Zappos's and the Amazons. And I saw something recently. I guess it was a Zappos, email that said, "Hey, you bought this particular shoe last year, and we have a few left, and we're wondering, if you'd like to get a brand new pair." It was that specific, and I really appreciated getting that because I actually like these shoes, and as you know, with sneakers, sometimes you buy them, and a year later they're out of style, and you can't find them anywhere at any price. So that level of and it's sort of simple stuff. It's not, none of this is rocket science. It's more of a thoroughness of thinking and a caring about your user experience. Let's shift gears a little bit here. Your area of specific expertise in this big world of marketing is the health arena. And you've done a lot of work in that area. Every year, for I don't know how many years running it is, you sponsor one of the best mastermind summit meetings on the subject of health marketing. You draw all kinds of people from sort of big mainstream health companies, people like the Rodales of the world and the boardrooms of the world, also a lot of entrepreneurs who are doing amazing things. I met a young man at one of your summits, I guess it was a couple of years ago, who is the famous for selling the six-pack abs product via the internet, and he does a phenomenal business. One of your guest speakers was Dr. Mercola, who's got a really astonishingly well-conceived and well-organized health publication, health product sales company. Can you talk a little bit about your experience in the health arena and how it differs, if it does differ from other markets, and the unique opportunities in health? You kind of alluded to it earlier, which is that health is a niche that isn't a niche because virtually every human being is concerned with their health at one point or another.
Yeah. Well, my participation in that market dates back to the beginning of my work supporting Rodale in the mid '80s. And for those who don't know, Rodale is best known for their brands of Prevention magazine. Prevention and also Men's Health magazine, which launched much later on, but has now been around for probably close to 20 years. And so I built client relationships not only with Rodale, who I work with for almost 20 years, helping to build their magazines and their book business, but companies like Boardroom, which of course is a misnomer, is a great consumer publisher, with lots of other publishers of both editorial content or health content support position, not only with universities and hospitals like Harvard and Tufts and Cleveland Clinic and so forth, but also by personalities, doctors, medical doctors, chiropractors, naturopathic doctors. So in the health market, positioning, unlike maybe it might be unique in that products in the health market are positioned in very different ways, typically by either a commercial brand like Prevention, a personality like a doctor, an institutional source like a university or a hospital, or a consumer advocate like Consumer Reports. Once again, the positioning means everything because positioning dictates that the marketplace will be a little bit different for, say, a doctor-edited newsletter versus a university edited newsletter. So you always want to look deeper no matter what market you're in. I don't care if it's golf, gardening, sailing, fly fishing. You always want to have a sense of how that market has subdivisions or different groups of people that look at it one way or another. An obvious example would be sailboaters and motorboaters who, generally sort of scorn each other, sneer at each other on the water. or in gardening, there's vegetable gardeners and then there's perennial flower gardeners. One's ornamental and one's to grow, fresh vegetables. Decorating your property and growing vegetables are two very different kinds of people. Some people do both, but lots do one or the other. And if you market to them together, you're really speaking to two different audiences and attempting to do it with one voice. So in the health business, it's very similar. It's much less obvious, but than what kind of seeds people are buying or what kind of boats they ride around in. But there are philosophical and sort of intellectual differences in the type of content, in whether the promise, and this happens in money too, in both health and money. The types of promises people make are you can be healthy or rich by tomorrow, which is for the most part, as we know, unrealistic, or you can be healthy and wealthy, in anywhere from weeks to months to years if you slowly, day by day, do the right things and create lasting, sustainable change. So as you'd guess, people that think they can be rich or perfectly healthy by tomorrow, it's a whole different group of people than those who believe that lasting sustainable change takes a little bit longer than that. So, that's just an example of under the surface how people tick, which is a lot of where I look and a lot of what I'll be discussing at the System Seminar in April, is to understand the unconscious origins or the you know, what I call the reptilian brain, you know, survival-based motivation that people have when they buy products, and to understand beyond their, you know, obvious observable behavior, what are their opinions? You know, what is the language that they speak? What are their concerns and fears? What kinds of companies and what kinds of authority figures do they trust the most? Or if they haven't demonstrated it before, what kinds of authorities or companies are they likely to resonate the most? You know, based on us looking at their prior behavior and either seeing what's clearly demonstrated and inferring the rest, what can we predict or envision about what these people will do in the future? And how should we speak to them? What kinds of language and what kinds of products make the most sense? So the health market is really so this amazing fertile territory for all of these kinds of considerations, you know, in terms of, you know, the type of people that are actually willing to take steps to prevent health problems. It's much easier to sell cures than preventions, because when people have something, they're motivated to deal with it. If they haven't come down with anything in their life, but they're 35 years old and they want to prevent the stuff they might get when they're 60, that's a pretty special group of very committed people. So these are the kinds of things that, you know, in the health market that are a little bit under the surface that really sort of are the, I think, are the key to the kingdom.
So what you do really has evolved, you know, far beyond the list brokering function into strategy, which includes which people to market to, copy issues, you know, what angle to take in a given piece of copy. And, you know, so beyond just, okay, we're going to mail to these people or we're going to market to this particular person. Also, even I think your work extends into the realm of product selection or product design. You know, how can a product be configured in such a way as to most appeal to a particular identified group of people?
Right, right. Well, I always, like a lot of people in any area of direct marketing, mail, web, TV, whatever, I got into it by accident. We could say there are no accidents, but, you know, it really was an unexpected and unintended outcome to end up in this business, although, you know, certainly an amazing thing. Sorry, Ken. What did you say a second ago? I lost my train of thought.
Oh yeah, no, just how, you know, you start in one area, which was you know, on the list side, which has a very particular discipline. You know, knowing the lists, knowing how to suggest lists that are worth testing, knowing how to track the results to predict other lists to acquire. But you know, then you know, expanding beyond that into getting a sense of copy strategy, and, you know, what kind of copy, what kind of approach, what kind of positioning is best likely to work to a particular list, what kind of products are likely to work to a particular group, you know, either creating those products from scratch or sourcing them. So you're, even though you started out as a list broker, your range of areas that you are expert in now has really expanded to cover the whole gamut, from, you know, the idea to actually getting the thing into people's hands. In fact,
right,
one of the reasons,
right,
you've got a cold today is you just got back from a flight from LA where you had a pretty high level meeting with a pretty high level marketer about a new product that he's about to launch, and I know that you were contributing on all the levels, not just, hey, this, let's go to these lists.
Yeah. Well, you know, and thank you for taking me back through that, with apologies to our listeners. you know, studying the products and the customers and the marketplaces over the years, you know, my particular path coming up in the direct mail channel was not just around, you know, list transactions. you know, I mean, in any business, in the web, in TV, in direct mail, any of the media businesses where our friends and clients and, you know, and students participate, you know, there's always the most admired players, and then there's lots of people trying to get in, and some are trying to break through with, you know, very noble, very responsible marketing and business efforts, and some are thinking just about the the money, you know. So I, you know, I've been fortunate to work with really wonderful, you know, clients and companies and ultimately human beings. And so, you know, I took all the, you know, the learnings and all the conversations I had with, you know, client CEOs and top people over, you know, the course of several decades. And I realized that, you know, I was, you know, capable, but also, you know, extremely interested in the way in which these companies are, you know, curated and set up and managed, and the, you know, the way in which customers are not only acquired but treated once they're, you know, kind of in, you know, come to the party, and how products are developed, and so, you know, the nice thing about the health business is that you really, you know, at the other end of each trend, and this is true in every business. The other end of each transaction is a real live human being that's counting on you for value and possibly even help. And it's really a sacred trust, whether you have, you know, 20 customers or 2 million, to the best of your ability. You have, you know, you can't sell people crap. You have to, you know, treat them like you would treat, you know, your best friend or your mom. And, you know, you have to, if you have a lot of customers, you have to systematize that level of care and support, you know, to create the kind of, you know, personal sense of relationship that really is, I think, required today to really succeed at the highest level. So, you know, I took everything that I had learned and even counseled my clients on in the course of, you know, essentially being accountable for, you know, list targeting, and created, you know, what I've been doing for the last 5 or 6 years, which is just a much broader advisory and consulting offering, which is what you've been pointing to. But, it's, you know, it's been, you know, just completely gratifying, you know, to work with great companies who care about their customers. You know, I live for the outcomes that that people are really getting from wonderful products and support. You know, I feel good that the markets are being served with great products and services, and so it's so yeah, it's business strategy, it's marketing, it's product development, you know, and sometimes I'm rolling up my sleeves and really, you know, what we call some of these ninja strategies, and a lot of times I'm at 30,000 feet, you know, helping somebody look, you know, 5 years into the future to the extent that that's even possible anymore, but. But I know that, like you, Ken, I'm having an awful lot of fun.
Yep. You know, and while, you know, some people may be involved in one or two businesses in their lifetime, and then others might, you know, because of their networking with colleagues, might become privy to, you know, half a dozen more businesses. In your case, over your career, you've—I don't know what the total number would be—but it's certainly in excess of 100. Getting very intimately involved with the details of how companies in this space are built, how they're grown, how they're maintained, how they sustain themselves through all different kinds of markets. I mean, Michael's drawing on a depth and breadth of experience that's pretty singular. You'd have to do a lot of looking to find something equivalent. So if you are interested in this kind of, you know, thoughtful, you know, deep approach to marketing, you know, something that is going to build businesses that are long-lasting and sustainable and you even have the potential to grow dramatically, this is, Michael's definitely a good person to have in your Rolodex as somebody to know. If you're in the health arena, this is a tremendous opportunity. You won't find anybody at a higher level in terms of experience, in terms of campaigns, witnessed and tracked in terms of the number of clients worked with. He really is the go-to guy in direct response for health related offers. So he will be one of our distinguished faculty, along with his a longtime friend and colleague, Brian Kurtz, from Boardroom. We're really very happy to have Michael. We've been something we've been trying to do since I met Michael years and years ago at a Boardroom dinner. And I'm so glad that at least at our last event, I finally was able to pull it off. This year we will be not in Chicago. We've been in Chicago for many years now, but this year we're holding the event in New York. It will be April 15th through 17th. For people that know the New York City area, we're in Jersey City, which is right literally, if you had a strong arm, actually maybe you'd need a slingshot, you could throw a rock from one end of the river to another. Actually, you'd have to have a really strong arm. I think a slingshot would be necessary, maybe a small catapult. But we're really on the other side of the river. There's a train for those of you, and I really encourage everybody. Hopefully, we'll have nice weather in mid-April. If you've never been in New York City, a great thing to do is take the PATH train, which is sort of a subway that leaves pretty close from our hotel right into Midtown Manhattan. Something I recommend everybody do as a simple, safe, fun thing is walk over to Fifth Avenue and just walk up Fifth Avenue all the way to Central Park and then down to Central Park West, Central Park South, excuse me, and to Columbus Circle, and you'll get a really sense of the sort of the grandeur of Manhattan, and then you can take it from there. But if you're coming in, fly into Newark. That's the best, easiest way to get to where we're going to be meeting. If you're confident navigating the city, I guess you could fly into any of the major airports, but Newark will be infinitely easier and more straightforward. That's April 15th through 17th, and we're going to have Michael, of course, Brian Kurtz, who we referred to in this call. We're going to have Josh Aston, who's a fascinating guy. He's responsible for driving leads to business Lexington Law. That employs over 700 employees, and he is the guy that makes sure the lead flow continues. He's got an approach to marketing very much like Michael's. We're going to have David Antley, who's a real super veteran of internet marketing. He worked at the Houston Chronicle when they were one of the first newspapers online. He was at GoTo, which was the first pay-per-click search engine. He worked with Mark Cuban, who developed Broadcast.com. And now he's done some really landmark work in the automated management of AdWords campaigns. It is really profoundly breakthrough stuff, and you'll be hearing it first at our event. Glenn Livingston, arguably the number one market researcher on the internet. He knows more about internet user behavior, especially as it relates to search, than anybody that I know by a mile. We're going to have Ben Hunt, one of the top web designers in the world. He's been designing websites since 1994, who recently, as a result of being exposed to the system, has completely changed his approach to web design and has now integrated a direct response philosophy into his design work. And he's going to be talking on that. It will be one of the first talks that he's given on that topic. We're going to have Greg Davis, who is a cutting-edge CPA marketer, is doing really amazing work. Mike Marshall, who is certainly one of the best SEO people in the world. He's the guy that when other SEO experts run into troubles that they cannot solve, they go to Michael and he sorts it out for them. And on it goes, with a lot of unadvertised guests who are going to be coming, not as formal faculty members, but it's just colleagues who are going to be hanging out and helping people. So April 15th through 17th, Michael Fishman, thank you so much. Value your friendship, value your colleagueship. Great you're going to be joining us. And thanks for getting on the phone with a post-LA to New York airplane ride cold. I really appreciate it.
Well, this was a huge treat. The name of the talk in April, if I can share that, would be how to know what your customers want and how to let them know you've got it. Maybe is what this all boils down to. But you know, we'll be talking about, you know, language, not only in terms of copy, but in the way in which the language of your business can actually be used to not only get lift, you know, really significant lifts of 20, 30, 40%, but even sometimes double or triple. So very actionable, very exciting. And, you know, thank you for this call. It's just an honor to be connected with you, and I'm looking forward to being together and with everybody listening right now.
Great. I'll see you in New York then, Michael. Thanks.